Welcome to Reimagining Liberty, a show about the emancipatory and cosmopolitan case for radical liberalism. I'm Aaron Ross Powell. Regimes falter when opposition media is strong, but America's legacy media has failed to live up to the dangers of the political environment and the authoritarianism of Trump's administration. We need stronger opposition media making full-throated defenses of liberalism. But what does that look like? I'm joined today by Adam Gurry, founder and editor-in-chief of Liberal Currents, which is currently fundraising to take their indispensable publication to the next level. Adam and I talk about the state of media, what it means to carve out principled opposition, and how stronger opposition media can see us through the coming years and towards a future for liberalism. Reimagining Liberty is a listener-supported show. If you value these conversations and want to listen to them a week early, you can become a patron. You'll get a special early access feed of the show, and you'll get my weekly roundup of my latest writing as well. Head to patreon.com/AaronRossPowell to learn more, or look for the link in the show notes. With that, let's turn to my conversation with Adam. Why do we need opposition media right now?
Right. I think there's two parts to that question. Why do we need it, period? And why do we need it now? And we need it, period. Well, I guess there's two parts to really the now. The part of why we need it now is because we're in an authoritarian consolidation in process, and we need to fight that. And there's tons of political science literature showing that one key way to successfully rebut an attempt like that is to have an actually mobilized opposition. And having an opposition media is a key part of that. It's a big way that you mobilize the public part, especially of an opposition. But even the elite part is well mobilized by an actual opposition that isn't suppressed. And so that's sort of the quick version of why you need it when you're in the situation that we're in under Donald Trump. The bigger answer is our media landscape in America has been a mess for quite some time. And it is a mess in a way that is very asymmetric. And that plays specifically into how we got into this situation in the first place, right? So on the one hand, you have established legacy institutions in the media that are mostly liberal or left of center culturally. And politically, to some extent, the longtime right wing criticism of mainstream media has some truth to it, in terms of the bent, and these institutions still see themselves as sort of mediators of the society overall, despite perhaps the liberal or Democrat preferences of some of the people there, their orientation is attempting towards neutrality. And not just for idealistic reasons either, but because they want to win back that audience of people who were Republicans too and would read the mainstream press alongside everyone else. And that would support the business model of them. On the other side, right-wing media has just been going for slaying the dragon, right? They are actually committed to defeating liberalism in this country by any means necessary. There's a donor network behind them that will just shell out cash to fund, the lifestyle of people all the way down to the level of conservative influencers and all the way up to the level of like Breitbart and, actual conservative publications and institutions. And they have their eyes on the prize. They're not pandering to liberals. They're not trying to be neutral. They just want to win. So there's that side. And then there's, the New York Times, the Atlantic, the Washington Post until recently, perhaps, they will report negative things about, Republican presidents and things like that. But they'll also, there's asymmetry between the negative reporting on Trump and the negative reporting on Joe Biden, which is just insane, right? Like, I would never defend Joe Biden as a perfect president, but he was not a dictator to be. But for the press, for a lot of them, the fact that he didn't give them access, for example, or didn't talk to them, nearly as much, was almost as bad as, you know, Donald Trump directly suing media organizations from his position as president, and things like that. So there's this asymmetry. That means we need actual press that actually just says Donald Trump is trying to be a dictator and we need to stop that. That's bad. He's trying to destroy a lot of the basic values that most Americans believe in. And that's bad and we should resist it. Whereas by contrast, just last week, The Atlantic published a huge glossy interview with RFK Jr., the guy who is doing more to destroy our public health infrastructure in this country, and is just sort of beyond that part of the whole milieu of crankish, anti-science, conspiracy-laden nonsense that comes out of the right-wing fever swamp. But, you know, The Atlantic, one of the big liberal publications, supposedly, is giving this guy a huge megaphone and, you know, sort of veneer of respectability.
Is the problem, so let's set aside the hard right media right now.
Of course.
And focus on the kind of mainstream legacy institutional media. Is the reason that it's in the state that it's in, and therefore opposition media or alternatives to it are so critical, is it cultural? Is it incentives? Like, why is it? Because there's a lot of, we both know a lot of reporters. We know reporters at mainstream outlets. These are not like stupid and evil people, right? Like these are smart and well-meaning people. When you talk with them, they recognize the severity of the situation. And yet, when you read The New York Times, The Washington Post, and so on, it doesn't seem to reflect that severity. Or you watch the major network news. But, and this is where I'm curious about kind of the culture and incentives and publishing structure, because it's not consistent, right? Like, you get in the hard reporting side, like right now, the thing that's happening is Hegseth is... The news came out that he maybe gave like a direct kill order, war crime. That was reported, I believe, in the Washington Post.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you're seeing that, but then it's the editorial pages seem to be, I mean, they're abysmal at the Washington Post right now. They're quite bad at the New York Times, with some, our friend Jamelle Bouie being an obvious exception. Like, but in general, they seem to be bad. So there's like this kind of schizophrenia going on with the way it's presented. What's going on there? Because again, there's that disconnect of you talk to the reporters, they seem to get it, and yet.
Yeah, there's a few things going on there. For one thing, I think one has to treat hard reporting as a separate category in some ways. For you and me, and for many people like us, hard reporting is, it's obvious what the value is, right? You know, hard reporting is probably the most underfunded thing in media and the most important thing, but unfortunately not the most socially important thing, if that makes sense. So to unpack that a little bit, getting that information is incredibly hard. And the work that reporters do to get it is incredibly important. But audiences do not respond to it for the most part. Some, there are exceptions. And when there are exceptions, media institutions, because of basic incentives, will latch on to it. You know, they've been hitting this Hegseth thing, not because it's even the worst thing that the Trump administration has done. It's not, there's too many, you know, to name. It's up there. I mean, it's pretty bad. But it's really not. Like, it's they've done many, many terrible things already, right? But this one has landed with audiences. And you never know which one it is going to. And it's usually just a fraction of what they report on that does. But once it does, they do chase that. I mean, that's just good business for them. So, you know, the brazenness of just shooting people hanging on to sinking ships has thankfully actually landed with audiences. And so that publications are chasing that. And, you know, even right-wing media, to open that door a little bit again, feel they have to respond. They can't just ignore it like they do most things, because they need to have some answer. People are actually talking about it. It's not something they can control. So there's that. That does, you know, that is a social impact aspect of reporting, which is important, and which institutions like even the Post now, and definitely the New York Times, and Reuters, and all of them, that can make an impact for sure. And when that happens, that's great, and you know they should get credit for that. But what usually happens is there's a lot of nuts and bolts reporting that gets done on mass deportation, the open corruption of the Trump regime, and you know any number of things like that are going on, and people pay like that will sometimes have an impact through, for example, it being cited in court cases as evidence. So that's like important because our court system is not completely undermined, thankfully. There are judges that care about the facts and reality, and the first cut of getting that reality is often coming from reporters. So that can have an impact through that institutional mechanism. It can also have an impact through elite circles of people seeing something is going on and devising a strategy. But what it doesn't typically do is mobilize the public in any capacity. Most of the public doesn't have a lot of patience for this kind of reporting. They don't really consume it in large volumes, except for the most engaged partisans who already want to oppose Donald Trump, right? If we're talking about people reading about bad things that the Trump administration has done. It doesn't have that overwhelming resonance precisely because it's a bit demanding, right? It demands something of the reader to go in and try and understand in detail, you know, first of all, read the details. Second of all, try and parse the context of what it really means. To give some background, for example, when we launched Liberal Currents in 2017, we were very philosophical in our focus rather than sort of nuts and bolts. And I felt as someone paying much more attention to what was going on then than I had been, say, like a year or two prior, that as a normal member of the public, your experience is that something gets reported as truly terrible, but then there's this feedback cycle where a couple of days later, people are saying, well, but that's not actually that different from what was going on under the Obama administration, or that's not really that much of a continuity break from standard practice. And it's not so much that those responses were correct, it's that unless you have a certain degree of knowledge yourself, it's impossible to judge the veracity of that. Is it actually a break from the past, or is it continuous with it? You have to know something first before you can do that. So there's a sort of fundamental epistemic difficulty of making the most of nuts and bolts reporting that is why it's as underfunded as it is, frankly. And it's why institutions like the New York Times still remain very valuable in my point of view, because they do pay real journalists. They do pay them to do that nuts and bolts reporting. So that's reporting, setting that aside. There is a huge cultural component. So for example, the publisher of the New York Times earlier this year wrote a huge essay essentially justifying their angle. And it's not just, by the way, opinion pieces, which agree they're pretty bad, but it's also the way they frame things in the reporting. So for example, Northwestern is reportedly going to be giving up $75 million or some huge amount of money to the DOJ. And the New York Times reported on this, but they also had a line that was something like, you know, critics of the administration call this bribery, but, you know, others say it's just part of doing business with this administration. You know, it's like they always have to have this kind of symmetric framing, even in the reporting, for something that's not symmetric. It is just corruption. You can just say it's just corruption, but that's not the New York Times' house style. And Sulzberger's defense of this is he says, we are not an opposition press. We're an independent press. So we will hold any, you know, Democrats and Republicans accountable. And that's important. And the frustrating thing is that in that essay, he even is very clear on what the stakes are. He goes through all the ways in which at that point, Donald Trump had specifically attacked the press that were unprecedented, right? You know, that were actually censorship in a way that no Democrat has done in modern memory. But still, his position is, no, that's why it's all the more important that we're just independent. We're not opposing. And that's fine if you want to frame it that way. But my sense is you can be independent and still call a spade a spade. You know, it's not opposition to just describe facts of the matter, such as that the Trump administration is extracting bribes from mainstream institutions. That's what's happening. You can call it that. So that's the cultural part. But there are some incentive parts too. And there's two basic incentives. The long-term incentive is, even if you piss off liberals, they will share your article. And if they share your article, you're more likely to get eyeballs on ads. And you're just more likely to get subscribers from people who may have seen people sharing it off pissed off, but actually agree with the article. So it's just good marketing to piss off even your own readers to some extent, or your own maybe loosely attached supporters. And the other thing is the Trump administration is being very aggressive against the press. They are looking for any in to attack them. And so this year in particular, and this didn't start this year, there has been a multi-year litigation strategy from the right to attack these outlets and just try and bleed them of money. Just from a self-preservation point of view, many of these outlets have been more cautious than they would have been in like the first Trump administration, for example, because that's been ongoing and it's obviously dramatically accelerated now that he's back in the presidency.
When you talk about mobilizing, and you've mentioned both mobilizing the public as a role and also mobilizing elites.
Yep.
What does that look like? Because that's different from, we often think of the role of media as informing.
Right.
It's to give the public or its readership, its audience information. But that's not quite the same thing as mobilization.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously political scientists, they're focused sort of on the social effects rather than maybe what we would think of as the in principle function of a press, like you said, of informing. It is both. I mean, the reason that dictatorships are more dysfunctional than democracies as a general rule is in part because they suppress their critics, and therefore information about things going wrong does not reach the dictator or leadership in any capacity. Because anyone who doesn't have skin in the game in the administration itself, and therefore feels more free to just say, hey, you're doing this wrong, has been attacked and suppressed by that very administration. Whereas in a democracy, there's tons of people, you know, crowing all the time. People in leadership can think, well, if there's smoke, there may be fire, and we should look into this. You know, you're more likely to actually get some error correction that way. So the information aspect does matter, certainly. And as I was saying about reporting, it matters as well in just uncovering those facts. But a lot of what media consumption does has a sort of intersubjective, like social role that happens. So you can think of it among elites as consensus forming in terms of what to do. You can think of it in the public as just general perceptions of how much support there is for the administration. So one important thing for any dictator, or really for any institution of authority, to be blunt, but especially for a dictator whose position is fragile by nature, is that how strong they are is very closely tied to how strong they are perceived to be. And, you know, there's some things that you can't persuade your way, you know, rhetoric your way around. Obviously, if they have a good patronage network that has consolidated the control of the military, then even if the public is in a rebellious mood, they're probably going to win the struggle. But once you're in a situation where it's actually a struggle and there potentially are bullets flying, you are in a much weaker position than just everyone is terrified of you, perceives you as being strong, and won't even try to fight you, right? And that's what you want to avoid, that scenario. And the way you avoid that scenario is large mass demonstrations, lots of media that is talking about your mistakes, and your immoral actions in venues that reach large audiences. So it shows that the dictator does not have control, fear, or respect of the public. It does not have the control or fear of the media. And then the media is providing that information on the bad things that they are doing, bad both in the sense of boneheaded mistakes and bad in the sense, you know, incompetence, but bad in the sense of morality as well. So you know, spreading the perception that even among supporters of a dictator, if they perceive that a large majority of society is against this dictator, they won't turn out themselves to go to the mat for them. So just getting to that level of, there's a lot of people that are against this person. He does not have the strength to stop them from saying it or showing it or turning out on the streets or whatever it is just incredibly crucial to either avoiding a dictatorship in the first place or, you know, opposing one that's already in place.
How does that work in our current media environment? So the New York Times is one of the few major newspapers that seems to be profitable.
Right.
But it has a huge readership, but that readership seems to be, I can't remember what the numbers are, but every now and then you see these things of how much of their money is basically people subscribing for Wordle and the other games. And it's a lot. It's a lot. But it's not being read by the 30% of people who seem dead set on supporting Trump,
right?
No matter what, or a huge chunk of the remaining people. It's a very niche audience, even by major newspapers. The media landscape is similarly just incredibly bifurcated into right wing and more progressive ecosystems, kind of the closed epistemology of the right-wing media sphere is really something to behold. Like when you talk with, you know, we all had Thanksgiving recently and many of us were exposed to kind of Trumpy family members who we don't normally talk with a lot. And one of the things you notice just how kind of closed their epistemic sphere is and how much stuff they believe that just like utterly just not true, but is like the lore within the right wing media ecosystem.
Yeah.
Social media splits us. The algorithms do it, but also the kind of Twitter diaspora and then splits along generational lines. Like all the olds are on Facebook and all the youngs are on Snapchat and Instagram and so on. Blue Sky versus Threads versus Twitter versus like the six people who are clinging to Mastodon. Like it's all just like a balkanized media environment. And so how does an opposition media outlet function in that? If what you're saying is you need to mobilize, so on the one hand, you need to like tell the people who disagree with the regime that the regime is failing, is weak, and so on, so they feel empowered to go out to the next No Kings protest or whatever
right.
that their mobilized opposition looks like. On the other hand, you need to convince the people who are supporters of the regime that the regime is weak and failing and unpopular and so on, so they will be basically demobilized in their efforts to support it. But I can't imagine, say, that like a lot of right wingers, except for maybe some elites who like to just get mad at the articles, mm-hmm. are, say, reading Liberal Currents.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. It's hard enough to get them to read the New York Times, right? Even with Ross Douthat, or however you say his name, in interviewing some pretty far right characters. And softballing it. So I mean it's a pretty complex media environment. We're in an information environment now. I would say if you think about the dynamics of how things go viral, for example, in a normal social media environment, that's always existed to some extent. It was a little harder to see in the era of big broadcasting. Because that was such a big game in town, you know, the concentration around the big three in this country was just so enormous in terms of its reach in the population that it's difficult for us to conceive of other models of influence where the individual media are a much smaller component of that, but they're still cascading effects that reach huge segments of the public. So yeah, the New York Times has like, what, 15 million, 20 million subscribers or something, which, I mean, hey, that's getting, that's up, not quite, you know, it's like what, 5 to 8% of the population. That's not nothing. But also the New York Times is read by the wreckage remains of the broadcast news folks, in as much as that still exists, and but also the cable news personalities. Long story short, they're also read by people who have yet more audiences. Cumulatively, all of those people have social media audiences. They have audiences of people who are influencers themselves and have not a million, you know, or maybe just 1 million, you know, single digit million or hundreds of thousands in their audiences. Messages do cascade. It's not a top-down phenomena the way that like the big three broadcasting model was very much. But it still can happen. And essentially the long story short is you just have to get into the arena and there's no formula. It's just kind of like a classical rhetoric situation. You have to actually, you know, carefully craft your message for the audience you're aiming at and have it the right timing for it to reverberate and have the effect that you want. And it's everyone who's in this business knows that it's not at all predictable. I mean, there's some things you can say, this makes it more likely or less likely, but often the thing that goes absolutely wild is not the one that you necessarily thought it would be. When Samantha Hancock-Lee wrote about Epstein and sort of like the pedophilia on the right, obviously we thought that one had some potential for going viral. But other times it's less predictable. She also wrote an extremely long, heady essay on the gender politics of the right. And that was one of our top performers that went very crazy popular as well. You get in there. It's not machinery. You're not pulling a lever and getting a result. But that's precisely why you have to get out there and just be constantly fighting on that battlefield. And the end result is influencing what Henry Farrell called reflective beliefs, which is, it's not just what people believe to be the case, it's what they believe they're supposed to believe as part of this like political grouping, for example, or are there a community of shared values. Much like the average New York Times subscriber, like you said, is playing Wordle and not necessarily reading in depth the nuts and bolts reporting that comes in, the typical member of a political coalition is also not hyper engaged. You know, they're not on top of 100% of the facts. And so just getting them to perceive what that coalition's general position is on something is a victory, even if they themselves aren't 100% sure whether they think it's true. If they know that the people in their coalition believe that, that's a victory, because in a moment of crisis, in a moment of mobilization, it's easy for them to then just sort of like fall back on that. It's also easy to make the case to believe that it is true, because they'll go around thinking a lot of people they respect believe a certain something. And then if some concrete event like this Hegseth one, for example, becomes big, that sort of helps consolidate the true belief beyond the reflective belief among that cohort as well. So in terms of, especially in a fragmented environment like ours, it's that first level of consolidating some reflective beliefs, some beliefs about what people think they should believe as good liberals in America, that is the most crucial function of opposition media now.
When you're operating then within these political tribes or coalitions that you're trying to mobilize, you're trying to reflect back beliefs because people are going to tune themselves to fit in with the group, which we see. I think an example of this is the, I'm always struck by the polling on support for gay marriage which went up and up and up and up and up. And then kind of Trumpism came in, the right pivoted, and it went down, 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 down.
Yeah.
And how much it seems like, it's not that a whole bunch of people were really supportive of gay couples and then stopped being supportive of gay couples, but that they thought the thing that you say is I support gay couples. So social desirability is a part of this, but it was just like, that's the direction things are going. We didn't really see politicians, like Obama was bad on gay marriage for a while until the winds were very clearly blowing in its favor and then shifted. And so what I wonder then is this gets us, maybe this is a, I hate to bring this into it, but like the popularism arguments. If you're operating within one of these coalitions, and so what you're trying to do is like reinforce these beliefs for the purposes of mobilizing people or just getting them to not feel as discouraged about the state of the world or the state of the future, that there's, you know, there is a path forward and so on. To what extent is the role to just kind of reflect back the existing views of that coalition in order to strengthen them, reinforce them, because there's people who are pushing against them? And to what extent is it to try to shape them in a more positive direction? And so I'm thinking of Liberal Currents has published on this, and a lot of the Liberal Currents writers are very vocal on YIMBYism and housing as an area where like progressives have been quite bad on housing. It has had profoundly negative effects on not just cities, but on the country as a whole. The policies that they push are typically the wrong ones to address this problem and so on. But that is a heterodox belief within the progressive left coalition. And so pushing on that can, on the one hand, like you could make the argument, like that moves things. If we can move more people to support, like just build more housing as the solution to the high cost of housing, which is a remarkably unintuitive thing to a lot of people, then that's good for the long-term health of the country. But on the other hand, if you're pushing hard on something that's heterodox within this coalition, does that end up having people in the coalition be suspicious of you in a way that then undercuts the other reinforcement? Like you basically have written yourself out of the coalition.
Right. Yeah. So I think this gets at a good point. We could talk, like when you talk about opposition media at a high level and mobilizing and coalescing on reflective beliefs, it sounds like a nice, neat process where it's like, okay, we all know we're against this guy. Like we'll have a set of things that we coalesce on and that's great. Like, but obviously, there's a lot of internal disagreement about what those reflective beliefs should be. And a lot of the opposition media space is going to be hashing out those things in a relatively public way, which can lead to bad blood, right? Bully between players. And that's sort of the risk of political coalitions in general, really, is that they are a gathering of people towards a common goal, but they don't always agree on all of the goals. And that negotiation can be difficult. YIMBYism is a funny one because, or a good one really, because I would say, I don't even know that it's heterodox any longer. It's pretty, in terms of the intellectual mind space, it's had a pretty overwhelming victory. I would say among Democrats specifically, like the actual elected politicians and people running for stuff, and among policymakers that they listen to. And that was a long process, right? I mean, obviously that was not the case 10, 20 years ago. And that was done through large public campaigns and books like Abundance and things like that. But also through a lot of just quiet work through local orgs, building relationships with the politicians in specific municipalities and things. So that, you know, that's a case of you have a long enough time horizon, and you can move the within coalition politics. For us, I mean, we feel very strongly that, you know, another thing about talking about the existence of things like people's beliefs about what they should believe is it sounds like you're saying you just need to give them a noble lie. But we, you know, that's not the case. And that's the problem with the right-wing media, right? Like, they are so far from reality. They're doing crazy things right now. I don't think to just to consolidate their power, but because they are generally genuinely detached from reality and have no idea what will actually work. The stuff they're doing is going to tank the U.S. economy, for example. I mean, it just will. And I don't think they want to tank the U.S. economy particularly. I think they would love nothing more than to have strong economic growth over the next 4 years. It just cements their control over things and their popularity. But their reflective beliefs are so idiotic and so deranged and so disconnected from anything concrete that they're doing a bunch of things that just don't make any sense. So I think it's important to have an opposition media that actually consolidates reflective beliefs so that you can mobilize, but it is actually important to be anchored to reality. And that is why the work of just ordinary reporting journalists is so important to help us get those facts that political institutions and legal institutions don't necessarily want to volunteer on their own. Or social institutions, you know, or corporations and nonprofits in that world, they all have their skeletons as well. And it's important to have external figures that are digging that stuff up so that we can know about them. But also, political science exists, right? Like social science exists, rather, and public health exists, and medicine and science in general exist. And if we are trying to coalesce around reflective beliefs, both for elites and for the public, we want to have them believing things that are true as we can make them, obviously, in a world with fallibilism. So we want elites who are in power, that once they're in power, are going to enact policies that will actually make things better, that will actually counteract, you know, the damage that the Trump administration has done, or mitigate against a future one like it. We want to actually address the problems of, you know, police violence without just saying to abolish the police or something, you know, or abolish, you know, it, like something anarchistic that's simply not going to happen. Give them something concrete they can do that will actually have a chance of succeeding. And that requires media institutions that are not only committed to opposing bad values like fascism, but also committed to seeking out the truth and promoting it to their readers and their audiences. So that's very important. I sort of lost the thread of the question that led to this answer, but you know, I do think it's important to say.
It tees up my next question, which is, so tell me about liberal currents.
Yeah.
In all of this, like we have touched on a fair amount of it, but there's clearly a need for opposition. The old legacy media has not been responding well to this moment for all of the reasons we've discussed. There's a real need for opposition media as you've defined it. Liberal currents is explicitly positioning itself as part of that opposition media.
Yep.
So what does that look like for liberal currents?
Yeah. So as you know, we have a fundraiser going on right now. And the goal of this is really to build us up so that we could take steps towards being more of an Atlantic, essentially, you know, doing what we think the Atlantic should be doing to some extent. In the beginning, you know, we saw the threat of Trump in 2016. Once he was elected, a few of us started working on launching this in response. The original idea was mostly just, okay, liberalism has gone stale in the sense that there are a lot of assumptions that a lot of people shared for a long time that have gone unchallenged in any serious way for a long time. And we need to get back to actually providing people the rationales for these things. We still very much believe in freedom of the press and racial equality, you know, just equality period, and the basic dignity of individuals. But we actually have to make the case for it, because obviously, like, I mean, Trump's victory in 2016 was a little bizarre in terms of our institutions that allowed it. It wasn't like it was a majority, but it was, or a plurality even, but it was a huge segment of society that went behind someone who just was very openly retrograde in several respects and illiberal in everything. So the original idea was just sort of the intellectual foundations of liberalism. As things progressed, and especially into 2024, as it became clear that he had a real shot of returning, and that it was going to be a lot worse this time, it became clear that we needed to shift to, I mean, we still do that, that's still part of our core mission, but to really just being in opposition and just calling out as clearly as possible the danger of a Trump dictatorship or Republican dictatorship. So that's been a lot of our focus over the last 2 years. But the way that we currently operate is essentially a fund used to pay writers that is managed by a volunteer editorial staff. So what we need is to get some actual staff, full-time dedicated to this project, to grow it into something on par with the Atlantic is sort of the model, an Atlantic that actually is truly committed to liberalism in this moment. How that works, there's a few aspects to it, so some of it is very tactical stuff. When the executive orders attacking law firms happened earlier this year, I wrote a very quick, very short piece that essentially said, the important thing in a situation like this is to stop bandwagoning. Right now it looks like we're on the cusp of enough of these law firms just trying to strike a deal with the Trump administration that the rest will bandwagon behind it. And one mechanism available for stopping a bandwagon would be for state bar associations to issue a statement saying that they consider those deals a breach of the oath taken when you got your license to practice law in those states. So if the calculus for law firm partners is we'll be run out of business if we don't make a deal with them, you can shift that calculus by having bar associations say, well, if you do make a deal, you will definitely go out of business because you will not be able to practice law. Obviously, that didn't happen. And it's not like I thought that was likely to happen. But as an opposition press, we believe it's important to put out ideas like that because I don't think people are thinking in those terms, in those concrete ways that they can resist what's happening. So that's one small part of what we do. Another part is sort of the next level up back of what is going on. How should we think about what's going on? How should we think about how to resist it and what to do next? And that's more the like Samantha Hancock's Lee, essay on what is this fixation of the right with gender, and talking about that, and sort of the diagnostic aspect of that. Then we have other things in the works that we will do if we are fully funded. One project in particular that I published about today, we call the Reconstruction Papers. It is gathering experts across several subject areas. So from higher education to actually the federal executive branch and how it operates, and Congress and reforming the judiciary, but also reforming the media, as we've been talking about, several aspects of society and the institution of the United States, writing essays that are not just about repairing the damage that Trump has done to those institutions, but acknowledging that there were problems with them before, because all institutions are flawed. And quite frankly, most of these institutions had reached a point of needing going back to the drawing board on reform, because they were designed at a different moment in terms of sort of like how the industrial organization of the country works, what our technological infrastructure was like, any number of realities, right? And they needed to be adapted to the present already. So these essays would, for a particular topic area, say higher education, say, hey, we had this great setup in the second half of the 20th century where we got higher education to a huge swath of society. We had research institutions attached to them, which pushed the scientific and technical frontier further than anyone else in the world, and partnered with industry too to get this stuff to consumers, in various ways. We had this great setup, but it had gone really sclerotic in the last 20 years. Now Trump has taken a wrecking ball to it. So here is what we're going to, here is what the 21st century version of this arrangement should look like, and that we should aim, you know, a democratic, you know, supermajority trifecta that can do whatever it wants, should go about implementing this, right? Because just being against Trump is not enough. We actually need a vision of what is America's liberal future, liberal and democratic future. And so that's, you know, that's the kind of work we want to do. We're not trying to win Trump voters back to reading liberal currents. That's not going to happen. We don't think that's necessary. This country is sorted into three broad political groups. One is Republican partisans, one is Democratic partisans, and one is loosely aligned with either side, slightly more aligned to Republicans on average. But really, like, some of them just never vote or rarely vote. And they can be. Democrats have demonstrated that they can win them. So our goal is mostly consolidating those, as I said, reflective beliefs among elites and the public, and as much as we can reach the public, about both the need to resist Trump, obviously, but more, even almost as importantly, what kind of future we want to be laying down beyond him, what we want to see afterwards. We're not just going to be in a defensive crouch forever. We're going to have our time to make some changes, and we need to make it count. And so that's part of how we see our project as well, a huge part of how we see it. This year, we met a lot of people. Samantha went down to DC for a conference, met a lot of people, liberals in good standing, who all were very shell-shocked by events, but they saw the danger of what's going on, but just felt completely at sea, had no idea what we should be doing or where we should be going, because their context had been completely shattered by events. So what we want to do is put the pieces back together again and say, here's what we need to be doing now, and here's what we need to be looking towards in the future. And that's the basic pitch for Liberal Currents.
For people who want to support this, where can they learn more? What could they do?
Yeah, so there's a GoFundMe for the fundraiser specifically that explains the basic outline of what we're doing and why. On liberalcurrents.com, we're doing updates as well about our progress with that, about what we plan to do in 2026. And obviously you can see our substantive work that we've done so far there as well. We're continuing to publish. Also on liberalcurrents.com, you can become a patron. There's a donation button there as well, so you can support us directly on there. You can also just become a free subscriber. With very few exceptions, our essays are completely free to the public, so you can just get it in your inbox. That's frankly a very good way to support us, so that we're less dependent on the vagaries of social media in terms of people getting reached. So even if you don't pay us a dollar, if you go and give us your email to send you each thing we publish, that's a great way to support us as well.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Reimagining Liberty. If you'd like to listen to future episodes free of ads and sponsorships, you can become a supporter for just a few dollars a month. Head to www.aaronrosspowell.com to learn more.